Welcome to Behind the Story, a program where we take you straight to the source. In this episode, we talk with education historian and researcher Diane Ravitch. From 1991 to 1993, Ravitch served as the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education. In this episode, KWBU talks with Ravitch about her memories growing up in the Texas education system, her thoughts on No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, charter schools, and the future of the public education system. Dr. Ravitch, thank you for talking with KWBU today.
It's great to be here in Waco. Thank you.
So you were born and raised in Houston, Texas, and attended public school there from kindergarten through high school?
Yeah, right. All the way through 12th grade.
So what was that time like for the education system in Texas? And what are some of the changes you've seen today?
Well, I think that first of all, none of the schools that I went to exist anymore. They were all changed into something else. But the big difference is, firstly, the schools were racially segregated. I graduated from San Jacinto High School, which no longer exists. It's now called Houston Community College. But I graduated in 1956, and the Brown versus Board decision about desegregation came out in 1954, and my school had not desegregated as of 1956, and I kept asking the principal, when are we going to desegregate? And he said, oh, no, you know, we're not going to do that. And everybody just thought they could delay and delay and delay. And eventually, long after I had left Houston, the schools did desegregate. But going to a segregated school was different, and many kids today, of course, I think a lot of schools today all across Texas have resegregated, and it's something that upsets me because I thought we were moving forward, and we seem to be moving back towards segregated schools. The other huge difference is I don't remember taking any standardized test, which maybe sounds strange to someone in Texas because actually to almost any school child in America these days because the tests are so omnipresent everywhere. And when I went to school, our teachers made their own test and graded them, and they had high standards. And some kids flunked and some kids advanced, but we didn't think that we were not getting the truth. We were getting the truth from our teachers because they knew what we had learned and what we hadn't.
And you said something really interesting there. You said you felt that schools are beginning to resegregate. In what ways?
Well, there have been a number of studies showing that there's more segregation today between the races than there was 20 years ago or 30 years ago, because after the Brown decision, there was a long period where the schools in the South fought desegregation. They eventually lost court case after court case, and then they got orders from the courts, and also the U.S. Department of Education held off money saying, if you don't desegregate, you're not getting any federal funding. That was in the mid-60s. And so schools across the South integrated, desegregated. And now because the courts over the past several years have been lifting desegregation orders and saying, well, now you desegregated, you're now free of any order from the court. And there's been a tendency across the country to have more and more schools that are all black and Hispanic, are all white, and there's also been a lot of suburbanization, it includes middle class blacks, but a lot of whites have left the cities and moved into gated communities, and don't interact with anybody else. There's kind of a sorting that's been going on, and I think that it's sad because I felt cheated as an adult because I didn't think it was right that I went to a segregated school. I would have liked to have had black friends. When I went to college, I think there was in a class of about, I was went to an all-girls college, but in my class there may have been one or two black students. It's now much more diverse. The college I went to in the Massachusetts is far more integrated. They have a lot of international students. So they have black students, Hispanic students, students from all over the world. But I felt, in retrospect, that I would have had a better understanding of the world as it is and as it's becoming if I had had more interaction with people from different cultures.
Early on, you were a proponent of No Child Left Behind, but you ultimately rescinded your support of it. that the idea of No Child Left Behind was somewhat predicated on what George W. Bush called the Texas Miracle. And this is when he was running for president. What's the Texas Miracle?
Well, I was, you know, there's two different stories. One is my own personal story. I guess that in the 80s and 90s, I found myself increasingly conservative because I'm basically culturally conservative. I believe in children reading great literature and studying history, and that's a kind of cultural conservatism. I don't believe in kids just, playing with video games or whatever. But I do think that it's important to learn the history of the country you live in, the history of the world, and I encourage a very strong liberal education. But I found myself very estranged from the kind of counterculture of the 60s and the kind of free-form stuff that was going on in the schools. And I was invited in the early 90s to join George H.W. Bush's administration. And that was in the middle of his one term. Lamar Alexander, who's now the senator from Tennessee, was asked by George H.W. Bush to become the Secretary of Education. And I was recommended to him by a mutual friend. And so he called, and I had never met him. And he called and said, would I come to Washington and talk? And I thought, gee, the Secretary of Education's never invited me to lunch in Washington. So I flew to Washington, and he said, I'd like you to be an Assistant Secretary of Education. So I joined the Bush administration, and I found myself supporting not only standards, which I had always believed in, but also testing and choice. And so I was very much embedded in a quite conservative administration, the first Bush administration. And I went on from there to be involved in three different conservative think tanks. So my own personal history was that I had like 20 years of being very much a conservative, and it's kind of an outcast in my field because amongst educators, it's not considered good manners to be a conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, because of No Child Left Behind, I had a kind of an epiphany. And I began to realize about 5 years into it that it wasn't doing anyone any good. And I saw that the scores weren't going up on the national test, and I was on the national board of the federal test. And there were many other things I saw in terms of the incredible emphasis on testing, teaching skills instead of teaching literature and the kind of great things that I believed in, which some of which I had in the Houston public schools and some of which I wished I'd had.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see education becoming better. I just saw it becoming more of a cash cow for the testing companies. So around 2006 or so, I began to feel completely out of sorts with all of my colleagues and my allies. And I began to say, I think I'm on the wrong side. So I began doing more and more looking, and I'm a researcher by nature. My field is history of education, and I like to do research. And the more I looked and listened and the more I saw what was going on, the more I began to think that No Child Left Behind was no miracle, that it was, in fact, a mighty hoax. And that there was no Texas miracle. And when I realized that the schools were not getting better, that kids were getting a worse education, that testing was going out of control and becoming an obsession, I didn't want to be part of that. So I wrote a book. It came out in 2010. It's called The Death and Life of the Great American School System. And the subtitle was How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. Well, that was like a declaration of separation from everybody who had been my friend and ally for the previous 20 years. And I traveled the country talking against No Child Left Behind. And then when the Obama administration came in, I found that their ideas were no different from George W. Bush's. And I began to be perhaps the most outspoken critic of Arne Duncan, Race to the Top, and the Obama administration's education approach, which is, if anything, worse than No Child Left Behind.
So for you, Race to the Top isn't any different.
Race to the Top, in my view, and I've written now two books about this. My second book came out in 2013. It is called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement. And Race to the Top is more punitive even than No Child Left Behind, because No Child Left Behind said, if you can't meet an impossible goal of 100% perfection by the year 2014, you may be closed. You may be turned into a charter school. You may be taken over. You know, all these threats, and nobody reached the goal of 100% proficiency, and no nation ever has. It was a ridiculous goal to begin with. But then the Obama administration came along, and they said, well, we're not only going to tell the schools that we're going to threaten them, we're going to threaten teachers. And so Arne Duncan promoted this idea that teachers should be evaluated by the test scores of their students. Now, that wasn't part of No Child Left Behind, and that, in a way, is almost the most poisonous aspect of Race to the Top, because it's been tried now for 5 years. Hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, have been spent trying to make it work. It hasn't worked anywhere. And in fact, Bill Gates, who was one of the big promoters of this idea, mm-hmm. gave out huge grants to maybe four different districts. One of them was Hillsborough County in Florida. And the Gates Foundation just cut the grant off. And they said, we promised you $100 million, but we're only going to give you $80 because we don't see any connection between the test scores and the bonuses that the teachers are getting for test scores.
Wow.
So we didn't really mean to offer you $100 million. We meant up to $100 million, and we're cutting you off. So that's an admission on their part that this huge thing of evaluating teachers by test scores, which the government has put a couple of billion dollars into, which the Gates Foundation has put probably another billion dollars into, it doesn't work.
I'm wondering, is the greatest opponent to public education the continuance of these high-stakes tests?
I think high-stakes testing is actually an enemy of good education. It warps education. People become obsessed with the test scores, and it leads to cheating scandals. We've had them all over the country. You had it in El Paso. There was a huge cheating scandal in Atlanta, and people were sent to jail. Another cheating scandal in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. And most of the cheating scandals haven't even been uncovered. But it incentivizes teachers to think that if they don't get those scores up, they're going to be fired. Or if they do get the scores up, they'll get a bonus. And then somehow the tests become more important than anything else. And across the country, there have been schools that have eliminated the arts. There are schools that don't have music and art, which to me is just unthinkable. I mean, there are schools that have eliminated recess, and that's unhealthy for children. I mean, there's a lot of research that says children need to be active. They can't just sit for 6 or 7 hours all day. And now we have these, you don't have the Common Core test in Texas, but around the country where the Common Core tests are given, children are having to take tests that last over a 3-day period or over a 6-day period for 10, 11, 12 hours. I mean, this is insane. I mean, I'm thinking of my own life, and I remember taking lots of tests of my reading and tests of my math and tests of other things, and it would be one class period. That would be 45 or 50 minutes. And now you have little kids, third graders, sitting for 8 hours, not in one day, broken up over 2 or 3 days. But I don't understand why a test has to last so long. It doesn't make any sense to me. And what a huge waste of money. I mean, Texas had a contract with Pearson for $500 million. Now, I know that you're not going to be dealing with Pearson in the future, but the very idea that the schools were cut in the billions at the same time that the legislature was giving $500 million to Pearson. And I would say that the Pearson had a better lobbyist than the Texas School Boards Association and the people who speak for children. But Pearson profited mightily, and there are lots of other companies that are profiting mightily by all of this whole approach. I call it a carrot and stick or test and punish. Mm-hmm. I mean, education shouldn't be punitive. Education should be, first of all, collaborative, and it should be about helping the children grow up to be healthy and responsible human beings.
And so much has been done to try to reform public education system, like the introduction of charter schools. And charter schools are another thing that you ultimately changed your view on. So I'm wondering, what is it to you that's made charter schools so bad now?
Well, the reason I initially supported charter schools, and I did when they began in the early 90s, and I was in the Bush administration, the first Bush administration at that time, and I thought, oh, this sounds wonderful. We'll have schools that are being innovative. They'll come up with new ways to help public schools, and they'll share what they've learned. And I thought this would be, as the originators proposed it, a way to give teachers an opportunity to find new ways of doing things for kids who are now failing, that charter schools would seek out the kids who dropped out, or they would identify the kids who are going to drop out, and they would help them, and they would share that with the public schools. That's not the way it's worked out. First of all, there's very little innovation coming from charter schools. The high-performing charter schools are like schools from the 19th century. They're very rigid. They're very strict. They're called no-excuses schools. Mm-hmm. All the children dress the same, look at the teacher. They track the teacher. Their eyes are not supposed to be off the teacher. They line up in straight rows. And it's somehow, being a historian of education, it's the same picture that I have of the schools I've read about from the 19th century. There doesn't seem to be anything innovative about it unless you think that a boot camp is an innovation. The other thing is that charters don't collaborate with public schools. They have come to see themselves as competitors, and there are some charter operators who have the intention of charterizing entire districts. They don't want to leave. They only want to keep public schools around as a dumping ground. So they see themselves as, we're better, our test scores are better. Of course, many of the charters that have high test scores skim. They cherry pick the students they want. They're the choosers. The students aren't the choosers. The students may be apply, but the ones who apply, but it's the charter that does the choosing. So when we talk about school choice, we're talking about the school's choice, because the school will choose not to take children who are English language learners. The school may choose not to take children with disabilities. And when they say that they have children with disabilities, when you look closer, you'll find they have children with very mild speech disabilities. They do not have the children with serious disabilities, and the public schools must take them all. That's their job. So I feel that in some curious way, we are resorting to having a dual school system. I mentioned at the beginning of our talk that when I went to Texas, I was in a segregated school system, one system for white kids and another system for black kids. That was called a dual school system. Now we will have a charter system for the motivated and a public school system that takes the kids who get kicked out or rejected by the charter schools. And I don't see how it's sustainable for our country or for our society. And it's not good for our democracy. There was a decision recently in the state of Washington where the Supreme Court of Washington State said that charter schools are not public schools because they're not under democratic control. They're not subject to the control of a local school board, and the local school boards are elected. I don't think that charter schools are public schools. And in fact, the charter schools have been, on many occasions, been brought into court for different reasons, like labor relations issues, where the teachers want to form a union, and then the charters say, well, you can't do that because we're not actually a public school. We're a private corporation receiving public dollars, sort of like Boeing. Or they have had cases where kids have been disciplined, and the kids have said, this isn't right, you can't kick me out, and then the charter says, we're a private school, we can do whatever we want to do. Or in the state of Ohio, the biggest charter chain in Ohio was sued by 10 of its own charter school boards because the company running the charters refused to tell the board where the money was going. They said they took 95% of all the money and wouldn't say how they spent it. Of course, the owner of the company, it's called the White Hat Management Company, was making millions of dollars. He was making large contributions to John Kasich, the governor, and also to the Ohio legislature. So his schools were all low performing, and he was never held accountable. And they never closed them down. They were closing down public schools right and left, but not his charter schools. And one of the reasons, I mean, there are many reasons I have objections to charters because of the way they've evolved. But I could spend an entire program talking about the amount of corruption in the charter world, the millions of dollars that have been siphoned off. There was there's almost every week there's another scandal where someone files an application in Florida to open a charter, gets $250,000 as a planning grant, and then disappears. And this has happened again and again and again. And there's a charter chain in Florida which has now built a real estate empire of $150 million of taxpayers' money opening charters. And it all belongs to the family that runs it. And the family has members who've been elected to the legislature who make sure that the capital spending is all on charter schools, not on public schools. I mean, across the country, whether it's Ohio or Michigan or Wisconsin, there have been terrible charter scandals, and there's very little accountability. Michigan just did their major newspaper, the Detroit Free Press, ran a week-long series saying we spend $1 billion a year on charters and there's no accountability. So there are many reasons to be concerned about charters, and the more I learn about them, the more I feel that this is a diversion of public funds. And we will see over the next 10 years more and more school districts going bankrupt because of the competition with charter schools, because the charter schools are favored by the people in the legislature to whom they give campaign contributions. They're favored by the Gates Foundation, the Walton Foundation, the Broad Foundation, the Dell Foundation, the John Arnold Foundation. You know, it's just a long list of all these the 1%, the billionaires who love charters because they love deregulation, they love the free market, and they want to privatize public education. And I think that would be a tragedy.
And I want to come back to that, but in a bit. Right now, I'd like to ask you about something I read on your blog recently. You recently wrote or mentioned that a report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation. I want to come back to that, but first, I'd like to ask you about a report recently put out by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. This report centered on the use of technology in classrooms and found that in certain cases, it's connected to lower test scores. With that in mind, do you think that technology in classrooms is detrimental, or is there a silver lining there?
School chains in the country, the biggest of them is called K-12, and it's a big money-making thing where the executives are paid millions of dollars a year. And they have very high dropout rates. The kids get very low test scores because they're not motivated. If they're sitting at home in front of a computer, you don't even know who's answering the questions on the test. But I think that the reason that the heavy use of computers is associated with lower scores is that young people, children, adolescents, learn more by being engaged with other human beings. That's not to say that technology is bad. I think that technology is very important. I think that it's necessary in the world we live in to learn how to use your computer and to be able to understand the digital world. It's only going to become more and more digital. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important, but I think that what that study showed is that if you use it primarily for instruction, kids are not going to learn as much as they will from a human being. I quoted the study, the OECD study on technology, from a Florida reporter, mm-hmm. because in Florida, Jeb Bush has pushed digital learning, and the schools there are now required to spend 50% of the instructional time on digital learning, meaning that they are required to do what's going to cause their test scores to be lower, which makes no sense at all. But Jeb Bush has taken a lot of money in his own foundation from technology companies, and he's a huge proponent of technology. And I think that, and as in most things, there's a middle ground, and he's gone way to the extreme.
We spent quite a bit talking about the problems in public education. So if we know what they are, what the problems are, can we fix it?
Well, I think the biggest problem in American education is poverty. In my book, Reign of Error, I show that there is this great misunderstanding about how we're doing. We're actually doing very well. We are the most powerful nation in the world. We are the most technologically advanced and economically productive nation in the world. So who created all this success? It was people, 90% of us were educated in public schools. And the Test scores today are the highest they've ever been in the past 40 years, and they were certainly much lower before that. And one of the things I'll mention tonight, in my Baylor lecture, is that in 1940, half our population had only an eighth grade education. So you think about it now. Now we think everybody should certainly finish high school, and as many as possible should go to college. We've made incredible progress, and the dropout rates are the lowest they've ever been in history. The graduation rates are the highest they've ever been in history. So there's this myth of failure, which is simply a lie. I think it's propagated largely in order to encourage the privatization of schools, to turn people against public education and to say, to convince parents that they should send their child to a charter or to a voucher school, which will be deregulated and where they'll learn creation science or something like that, not even be part of the 21st century. So I think that our big problem, and it's huge, is that about a quarter of our children live in poverty. And almost half of the kids in this country, actually it is half the kids, live in low-income families, but a quarter live in really low-income poverty, where they're eligible for free lunch, not just reduced lunch. We have more child poverty in this country than in any other advanced nation in the world. And if you look at test scores and you think they're important, the most reliable predictor of low academic performance is family income. Standardized test scores could be considered a family wealth index. And the rich kids have scores at the top, and the poor kids have the lowest scores. So if you want to raise scores, we should be doing something to raise up the kids who are in poverty. And we have a society that has a tremendous inequality in terms of income and wealth, probably more than there has been in 100 years. If we could reduce the inequality, and I'm not saying this as a socialist, I'm saying it as an American, we didn't have this kind of inequality in the 1940s and in the 1950s. America was a country that took care of its people and tried not to have these extremes where some people were billionaires and other people were living with nothing. I think that if we would be a happier society if we took vigorous action to create jobs, rebuild our infrastructure, and make sure that we could reduce poverty to levels that were equivalent to those in Asia and in European countries, because they way surpass us in terms of health care for children, early childhood education for children. And those are the factors that matter for having better performance later on.
And, you know, that leads me to my last question, which was centered on poverty, because I know you said before that the best indicator of low academic performance isn't a bad teacher, mm-hmm. it's poverty. So I'm wondering, is when it comes to these attempts to improve the public school system, is there too much focus within the school and not enough emphasis placed outside the school, like looking at these issues of poverty?
Well, to begin with, I've never made it an either-or issue. I think that schools can always get better, and they have to have an ethic of continuous improvement. And I think that in any school that's a good school, teachers work together collaboratively as a team. It's one of the reasons why something like merit pay has never worked. Texas had a huge merit pay program. It was a disaster. Every time merit pay has been tried, it's failed because teachers work together as a team, and they know that collaboration is what makes the school tick. It's like a football team, a basketball team. You do it through cooperation, not by trying to beat the person who's on your team. But at the same time, I think if we ignore the root causes of poor academic performance, which are poverty, number one, and segregation, and the combination is toxic. I think that it's impossible to improve our schools without taking care of the condition of children's lives. If they go home to a community where they don't have medical care, they don't have food, they don't have secure housing, their parents are bounced from place to place, or they may have one parent and the other parent's incarcerated, they're living in terrible circumstances, and America should be ashamed of that. That's something we have got to act on and to continue. Blaming teachers is simply ridiculous, and it's, I think, on the part of the 1%. This is a dodge on their part because it's a lot easier and cheaper for them to open charter schools than it is to say, what are we going to do to raise up the 20% of the people at the bottom who are living desperate lives in this country.
Dr. Ravitch, I want to thank you again for talking with KWBU today.
Thank you, Carlos. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That was education historian and researcher Diane Ravitch. You can find this episode of Behind the Story and past episodes on our website at kwbu.org.